Oh, not the right environment. Other people talking, no.
What's going on? How's Overcast?
Going great. I talked for 2 hours about it on Debug last night. Go there to hear more, because I don't want to flood our show too much with it.
Too late.
So I flooded their show instead. And guy asked me to be on Debug a while ago, and I kept delaying it. I kept saying, oh, I'll just wait until I release Overcast. That way we have something to talk about, and I can promote it and whatever. And I've been putting it off because that was probably back in February that I said that. And so I've been putting it off for quite a while. And so finally I went and I talked about it there for a while. Some of the more low-level tech stuff, and then kind of app business and social stuff. Like, how do you break into the social crowd? How do you break into the business? Stuff like that. I'm pretty happy with how it turned out. So we'll see. I don't know when they're going to post it, but we'll see.
I haven't heard all of your Overcast tour, so maybe you talked about this, or maybe you don't want to talk about it, but in case no one has asked, what are your conversion numbers like, if you want to share that?
I don't even know off the top of my head, but they're pretty good. I would say, I don't even know what a percentage would be, because I just know like dollars and total, which I don't really want to share, but
I was going to ask just to be a jerk, but you beat me to it.
But anyway, you're happy with it? It's more or less what you expected?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, like, it's so early right now that, you know, because it's only been out now as we record this for 8 days. And so it's still on its launch high. You know, it's still featured in the App Store. I think today was its last day. So it was featured in the App Store until probably midday today. It, you know, it might be featured somewhere else this week, but I probably not. I don't know if they do 2 weeks in a row for anything. And it had all of its launch press. So I really have no clue what like the resting point will be. Like, what's going to be like the common everyday income from it? You know, with Instapaper, I knew that number, and it wasn't always the same, but you know, it would be the same for like a month, and it was always within the same ballpark. It would gradually go down over time if I didn't do much, you know, with the app, but it was pretty predictable for the most part. And so I don't know what that level will be for Overcast yet. And I won't know until probably like a month or two from now, you know, really what that is. I can tell you that I've had something like, I don't know the exact number, something like 100,000 or 160,000 downloads. And of those, a little more than half have actually made a user account. And that's an interesting ratio. The problem is, again, that will be more interesting later. Like, it'll be more interesting in a few weeks or months once all this stuff has settled down. I wasn't sure, like, you know, because the whole thing about needing to create an account to use it, that was a decision I made for various reasons. I think I already went into them somewhere, but they're pretty boring reasons. But that was a conscious decision. I know I could, you know, just generate a random ID and use that, but there were lots of reasons I didn't want to do that. Mostly involving sync to new devices and people forgetting that they have this account and then creating duplicate empty accounts, and then it's a support issue and they think they lost all their data. It's a bad scene. Anyway, so, you know, roughly a little more than half right now have actually created a user account. But I don't know, I'm not doing any analytics yet in the app to know, like, how many of those people who didn't make a user account have even launched the app yet. You know, like, it could just be people downloaded the app because it was featured, and they haven't even launched it. It still has the blue dot next to it on Springboard. You know, it could be many of those. It could be people launch the app, they see the login screen, they say, I don't want to create an account, and they close the app and never launch it again, or they delete it. I'm sure it's probably a mix of both. I don't know what the ratios are. So anyway, that's probably something I should put analytics in the app so I could know and maybe educate that decision going forward. But
right. Now, Matthew Palmer asked an interesting question in the chat. Have you been paying close enough attention to, like, server load to see roughly when the peak was?
The peak of just, like, server activity in general was a few hours into launch day. As far as I can tell, the being featured in the App Store does not cause a big spike. It causes, like, a general rise in the whole week because people aren't all checking the App Store at the same time. And so that has just, like, lifted the average for the whole week, and I expect next week's average to be substantially lower. But I'm not going to really know that again until, you know, a couple weeks from now when I can look back and see the patterns, see the data. as far as I can tell, I'm not going to need all 8 of my web servers that I created, but I haven't killed any of them yet because I want to do some experiments and stuff, but it doesn't matter.
Fair enough. Anything else you'd like to share about Overcast?
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, I don't want to bore people with it because who already heard me talk about it for about 6 hours now, but yeah, I guess if you have any specific questions, write it and we'll see if we can answer them, but I don't know.
John, any other questions regarding Overcast?
No, nothing except for like tech support questions. I'll just email Marco and add it to his
email. fair enough. All right. So we've had something that is possibly follow up, possibly not, depending on how you classify it. And it's been in the show notes for weeks now, but we've had more important things to talk about. And it's about the emails that Ed Catmull from Pixar had written long ago that were recently revealed. And John, I think you're probably most qualified to talk about this. Do you want to give us kind of the blow by blow?
I was trying to remember and get a link for the show. It's a past show when we discussed the Apple Google sort of not really direct wage fixing, but the little agreement they had to not poach each other's employees.
It was more than just them. It was a lot of big tech companies.
Yeah, Apple and Google were the headliners because they're, you know, and they had emails. It was part of a court case. That's why we got to see emails from Steve Jobs. And I was incredulous about the Google sending the emails to talking amongst themselves, to say, we want to hire this guy, but Steve Jobs might not like it. So get his okay first. And then Steve Jobs says, no, I'd actually rather you not hire this guy. And then they don't hire him. And we complained about that. This story is about a same thing, a courtroom case where that's why we're seeing these internal emails and that's why this information is public, this time involving digital special effects companies, or some of them anyway. One of them is Pixar. What was the other one? It was Sony was the one who was not playing by the rules and was poaching people from Pixar, and Pixar was all cranky about that. And Ed Catmull is heavily featured both on the witness stand and in these emails. And the last time we talked about Ed Catmull was about his book Creativity Inc., which I really liked and talked about on the Incomparable, an episode we did just on that topic. And these emails show that he was involved in this wage fixing, you know, what I don't, it's not, we don't call it wage fixing. What's the best way to describe this?
Wage fixing?
Wage fixing is the result. It wasn't quite the action they took, but that was definitely the result of the actions they took.
Yeah, but anyway, it's the same exact thing that the other tech companies were involved in. All these companies are like, the heads of these companies are like, it's best for all of us involved if we just promise not to poach each other's employees. So don't cold call our people at their desks if you get their number and say, hey, come work for our company. We do a similar thing and we'll pay you our money. Just don't do that to each other because it's just a hassle for all of us to have to worry about these people leaving and so on and so forth. And it's the exact same situation with Apple and Steve Jobs and Google and all these other tech companies in that... The result is that the marketplace for these people's skills is not as competitive as it should be, because these guys are essentially agreeing not to pay the people what they're worth just to make their lives easier as the heads of the companies. And as much as I admire Ed Catmull, he's doing the exact same thing here. And seeing this, both in the case of Steve Jobs, who I also admire, and Ed Catmull and Pixar and all these companies, you just have to think about, what is it that makes these people think that this is an appropriate thing to do? Especially Ed Catmull, who makes a point in his book of specifically... highlighting instances where he did something for moral reasons, even though, you know, like not taking advantage of employees, not working them to death, not doing all these strategies that other companies in the tech business do, not because it's bad for business, but because it's immoral, because you'd be exploiting your workers. This is exactly as immoral. And I'm thinking, like, what happens to you that you get into a space where you believe you're doing your job well, and you're also a good person, and yet these are the decisions you make.
Do you think it came down from Jobs that he maybe didn't want to do it, but Steve Jobs said, you have to, this is the way it is?
No, it seems like, I mean, it's kind of a Masters of the Universe thing where at a certain point, and despite all the things they say in Creativity Inc., and one of the things that Ed Catmull talks about is it's very difficult to know when this is happening to you. So the relevant part for Creativity Inc. is when they're having these meetings, and they wanted to have these meetings where everyone could have a voice, and they didn't want there to be any sort of class structure, and they would invite everybody to these meetings, and you know, would all talk together, and they were intentionally trying to make it, don't feel like you can't speak up because you just got hired a week ago, and you know, I'm the president of the company, everyone's input is important. But I forget the details, but it was something like, that's all well and good, but when you came in the room, they had like arranged seating so that the important people got the good seats in the place where everybody could hear them, and other people had to be like sitting on the radiator in the corner. And of course, they never felt like they could jump in. And they did this for a long time until the executives realized the reason other people aren't jumping in is because we, you know, we are the executives and we get the good seats, and it makes, you know, we're marginalizing them unconsciously. And so they abolish the assigned seating, let people sit wherever they want. Executives don't automatically get the good seats or whatever. And, you know, again, Creativity Inc. is all about, you're not going to see that that's happening. You're going to think you're doing everything in an equitable manner and you're not. And this seems like an even worse case where he's on the witness stand. He doesn't seem, you know, like he's apologizing for this. He doesn't even seem regretful or whatever. He's just sort of stating the facts the way they are. When you're running a company, you're like, I'm doing a good job, aren't I? Like, this kind of churn of employees going from place to place, that's bad for everyone's business. Like, we want to just, you know, I'm going to treat my employees well and do right by them. But it's no good if these employees keep going to the better offer from one place to the other. If we, you know, that's just too much churn. And maybe it is inconvenient for the people who run these companies, but that's not, if you're the head of the company, it's not your job to dictate the lives and job prospects of the people under you, right? It's not indentured servitude. It's an employment at will. You can fire them whenever you want. They should be able to leave whenever they want. And you, by illegally colluding with other people in the same industry to say, don't give that guy a better opportunity anyplace else. If you agree to that, I'll agree to that for your people. We'll just keep all our people and we don't have to pay them what they would get paid otherwise. How do you square that circle? Like, and I think it's more like you just feel like you're doing what's best for the company. You're doing your job well, and you're trying to make your people happy. And you're like, oh, look, no one is hurt there. And you don't see that you are essentially deciding, you're controlling people's lives in an improper way. And I think as you move up in the executive ranks, and I've seen this in many places to varying degrees, you lose touch with the rest of the world. You start to think you are different than other people, even in a sort of egalitarian company where they don't like having assigned seating in meetings. But most companies are not like that. Most companies are like, I'm big people, you're little people. I make a salary that has more digits than your salary. I drive a nicer car. I have a personal assistant. I have a secretary. I don't keep my own schedule. I get to come and go as I please. You know, like all these things just build up this sort of image of yourself that you are different than the other people. And even if you're magnanimous and like, you know, you're like, I'm the benevolent dictator. You're still the king. You're like, but I love my subjects. I treat them well. But, you know, and it's really difficult to fight against that. Even apparently, even if you're Ed Catmull, no analytical engineering style brain is apparently enough to completely resist that. Although I'm sure there are exceptions. I can think probably John, that would never happen to John Carmack because he has too much nerdiness and not enough of the other things to ever get him into that headspace. And now someone should send me a story about John Carmack doing something similar and I'll cry. But I'm sad to hear about, you know, my personal heroes making a mistake. And I'm sadder to see that, as far as I can tell from, you know, witness stand testimony, which may not be representative because a lawyer probably advises him just to stick to the facts, that, you know, your heroes have flaws too, and they make mistakes, and this was a bad move, and it makes me sad.
You know, it reminds me of the episode of Top Gear where James May drives you knew I had to go there, where James May drives a Countach.
Everything reminds you of an episode of Top Gear.
It's true. It's kind of sad. But anyway, James drives a Countach, which was his favorite car when he was growing up or whatever. And he realized that his fantasy car was an utter piece of crap because you can't get into it, can't get out of it, can't see out the back. It's impossible to drive, impossible to park, and it's awful. And he said, you know, he kind of wished he had never driven it in the first place because it ruined it for him. And I'm not saying that this is a perfect analogy, but it reminds me of it nevertheless.
That's how I felt when I finally played a Sega Saturn.
You and I are the king of terrible analogies. Kings of terrible analogies.
I mean, like, it's not as if I thought anyone was perfect. Like, Steve Jobs is the perfect example. Anyone who knows anything about Steve Jobs, you can admire him all you want, but there are so many terrible stories about him that no one is ever thinking that Steve Jobs is perfect and then has those dreams crossed. Like, it's part and parcel of the reputation, whereas Catmull's reputation was just so much like, everything that's bad about other high-powered executives is not bad about this guy because he's, you know, he's the nerd's nerd. He's the engineer. He's able to not fall victim to all those other things. He's not a jerk in the way those guys are jerks. He's soft-spoken and thoughtful, and look at this great book he wrote, and look at all these talks he gives, and all that. This doesn't take away from all that. All that is good just as much as this thing is also bad, right? And so, you know, it just goes to show that everyone makes mistakes. And like, the worst thing about it is like, does he think it's a mistake? Or does he think like, well, if we didn't do this, it would have been, you know, there's lots of rationalization. If we didn't do this, it would have been worse for our employees because of reasons X, Y, and Z. But And you can say, well, the laws against collusion, I don't agree with them. I think those laws shouldn't be there, and therefore I'm breaking an unjust law. It's not a big deal. But I would hope that in any sort of extended conversation on the topic, he could be brought around to the notion that is so clear to all those of us who are the peon workers, that this is a terrible thing to do to anybody, to collude with other companies to limit the employment opportunities. Like, that's not how you keep your employees, by just making sure that they don't have other job prospects. Even if you treat them super well, which by all accounts they do, or at least try to, it doesn't matter. You don't get to do that. You don't get to say, because I'm so important, not only will I'll keep you here, not just by treating you well, but by sort of making sure that you don't have any better prospects elsewhere, despite the fact that if we didn't have this deal, you know, like Sony, who wasn't following these rules, was like, we'll offer you more money. We'll put you in charge of an entire movie. Come over to our company. And, you know, employees would leave and they'd be like, oh, we don't want that. Well, if you don't want that, pay those people more, make them happier. That's called a competitive marketplace. It's disappointing. It's sad. It makes me angry that this happens to people, because, you know, not that I'm in the digital animation field, but if the similar thing was going on, you know, and I was looking for a job, or, you know, it's not just looking for a job, but if I had a job and I knew that some other company wanted me to work for them, but they had an agreement with my company that they wouldn't poach me, I would be pissed.
I would be too. And Marco doesn't know what that's like. So tell me about something that's awesome.
This week we are sponsored by our friends once again at Hover. Hover is, in my words, a domain registrar that is actually good. There are many domain registrars that are not good. In fact, I would say pretty much every other one I've tried. Last time I was registering domains and looking to leave the let's say the elephant in the room, I got suggestions from all sorts of people about whatever registrars they use, basically, is what people always recommend. Like when you ask people for recommendations on anything, they just tell you what they use. And I tried a lot of them, actually. And I really didn't like any of them very much. And Hover was definitely my favorite. It was the one that it was not only the only one that I really liked, but clearly the best in the bunch. And I don't even use most of their features, honestly, because they have all sorts of cool stuff. So let me go through the basics. Hover, of course, lets you register domain names. You guys know what that is. I'm not going to explain it. You can register domains. You can, you know, get host. I don't think they offer full-blown web hosting, but they do offer email hosting and you know, all the domain stuff you need, DNS, all the stuff that you think should come with it does come with it. You have privacy, Whois privacy built in for free for any TLD that supports it. Some of them have weird restrictions that don't allow anyone to do that, but most of them support it. Hover gives that to you at no charge. They have amazing support, and they have a beautiful interface. You know, managing this stuff is all like this nice web interface. They have amazing support, where not only can you go online, of course, they have those options, but you can even call them on the phone, and a human being picks up the phone. They have a no-hold, no-wait, no-transfer phone policy. So you just call this number during business hours, and you talk to a human immediately who can actually help you. It's really quite amazing. They're running a sale right now. So we have all these new domain extensions, things like, you know, dot plumbing and all these crazy domain extensions. Now they are running it until September 1st. These are, let me see, I think it's half off. I don't know if it's I don't know what the sale is, but they are on sale. I believe they're pretty steeply discounted. So all these new domain extensions that have come out over the last few months that are mostly useless, but there's a couple of good ones, all of those are on sale now at Hover through September 1st, or until September 1st. I believe this is the dot dot greater than or dot dot less than operator in Swift for this range here. So until September 1st, these are on sale. See, I'm learning Swift. I told you I would learn it
or something.
I'm learning a new language, guys. Give me some credit.
Mm-hmm.
I even paid attention to when they changed the syntax like a week ago. See, mm-hmm. I read the internet. So head over to hover.com, see the full list of all these crazy new domains, or you can buy one of the old ones. They're fantastic. They have also this great value transfer service. One of our friend of the show, Joel Hausman, was telling me that he had a transfer, and I don't think I'm allowed to go into all the details, but he had to do a pretty large transfer of many domains into Hover, and he used the value transfer service for it. And it's a number that I would assume that if Hover had some asterisk somewhere saying we won't do this for more than X domains, I would have assumed this number was above that. But they did it, and it worked great. And they did this whole transfer of many domain names from the old registrar, where if you choose to, you can, you basically just give them the login to your old registrar, and they will move it all over for you. And you don't have to. Of course, you can move it yourself, but moving domain names sucks because you gotta like make sure you got all the DNS settings correct, and you know, don't drop anything on the floor. Otherwise, then your server goes down for 8 hours while new things propagate. Anyway, go to hover.com. It's just a registrar that's good, basically, and that's quite a feat in this industry. I use it. Lots of people use it. Check it out. Go to use our promo code. New this week, promo code. I hate you so much. Maybe nice. one of the hosts of this show might say that frequently.
Whoever could that be?
Something like that. So go to hover.com and use promo code I hate you so much, and that will get you 10% off your first purchase. And tell them that you came from us, which will make them keep sponsoring our show, which will make us keep making shows. So everyone's happy. Thank you very much to Hover for sponsoring our show once again.
Excellent. All right. So today, the day that we're recording this, which is probably roughly a week before we release it, is the first day of the public beta for Yosemite. And I haven't even registered for it.
You should. It's capped to 1 million people. You better hurry.
Oh, I would have assumed they were all just taken as soon as they started. But
me too.
I don't know. Like I don't know if they announced anything about whether when I heard that it was capped at 1 million, I'm like, do 1 million people really want to run a beta OS, a beta app, maybe, but a beta OS, like that's all, you know, you got to do the whole installation procedure and it's all different and weird. And like, I don't think 1 million people are probably equipped. Well, yeah, I guess maybe they are. Let's say equipped in terms of having good. Do you think 1 million Mac users have good enough backups that if they install the Yosemite beta and immediately erase their entire disk, they would be fine?
No, definitely not. But they will.
Maybe. What's the install base of Mac users?
Oh, I don't know.
I would guess in the maybe around 100 million range, something like that. I don't know.
So it's like 1% of, do you think 1% of people, I think 1% of Mac users might have good backups with Time Machine and everything. 80 million, says the chat room, installed base of Mac users. Anyway, we know that most of the people who install this beta are not going to have good backups, and chances are they'll be fine. But like, you know, people are their own worst enemies, and people just like to be daring, and there's just a bunch of kids. Like, I mean, I know if I was a kid, I would be like, yep, I'm installing this on the family computer right now.
Like, oh, I would have, no question. I mean, like I did with Windows 2000 when that beta came out.
Yep.
When I tweeted about this, I was like, look, we've talked about this on the show. I don't generally recommend people install betas. A beta means it's not finished. It means there's going to be bugs. Have backups, blah, 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 the whole nine yards. It's best if you could do it on a spare machine. If not that, on a spare hard drive, all this stuff. And then people are like, oh, you're being too conservative or whatever. I'm like, yeah, I mean, like I said, when I was a kid, I just would have done. But like, that's why I kept screwing up our computers when I was a kid. It's part of the learning process. I don't tell people they can't do it. But if someone installs this, and you know this is going to happen no matter how many disclaimers you give, and there's some bug that causes data loss, they're going to be super pissed. They'd be like, how dare this Apple? But it's like, it's a beta. Like, you did it to yourself, you know? Even in the release version, like, there's always going to be bugs. Like, every piece of software comes with that big, giant, all-caps thing that says, this software is not useful for any purpose. Like, whatever the hell that text is, do you have that?
The warrant, it's like a warrantability something, like disclaimer of warrantability, something like that.
Not suitable for any purpose.
Yeah.
Like, no matter what you think the software is good for, we're saying, nope. We do not say that the software is good for anything.
Even if it directly contradicts what was on the box.
Right. Like if we put on the box, this software can add numbers together. Nope, we're not promising anything. It might just erase your disk and that's it. Anyway, so, you know, people just have to use their own conscience, and like, kids and adults will make mistakes. People will lose data. That's life. But just because Apple releases something publicly doesn't mean it is of the same stability. Beta actually does have a meaning, and it means not done yet. So, you know, go for it. Use your conscience as your guide. So, I mean, that's why I thought 1 million is maybe not outside the realm of possibility, because 1 million people may want to do this. There's probably 1 million kids who want to install this on their parents' computers and have an Apple ID. So that's there's your 1 million right there. I mean... The real question is not so much who's going to install it and how are they going to go, how is it going to go for them, but why is Apple doing this?
Yeah, I don't know.
That's a very good question. I wonder if it has to do with the IBM thing. I wonder if this is about enterprise stuff, you know?
How so?
Like giving enterprises, being able to go to enterprise customers and say, look, we're becoming more open. We are now doing public betas to make our stuff a little more palatable to your IT departments.
I don't think it's aimed at IT departments. If you remember, they did public betas for 10.9.3 and 10.9.4. Do you remember that? Probably not, because most people don't. But they actually did do public betas of OS 10, the 10.9.3 release, and the 10.9.4. And who cares to have a public beta of a point release? Because, like, there's nothing, you know, it doesn't look any different, really. They probably fixed some driver issues or whatever. I don't even install the point releases, you know, even though I'm on the Mac dev program and I get all the emails about it. But this was a public beta of 10.9.3 and 10.9.4. And that was sort of the warm-up round for, you know, the public beta of these things. And I think Apple got good results from the 10.9.3 and 10.9.4. So again, with the betas, it's like, why bother going to the public, especially with 10.9? Do you really care if, like, regular non-developers download 10.9.3? Is that getting you any information that you're not already getting from developers? And the answer is yes. The answer is that a different class of person downloads this type of thing, and they use it in a different way than developers use it. Developers are probably using it to test their apps or to test whether their pet bug is fixed. But regular people don't have apps, and they don't have, maybe they have pet UI bugs, but they don't have like pet API bugs, right? So they're gonna install it and use it like a regular computer and find things that developers wouldn't find. And that's, I think, why that Apple is going with the larger beta. And people in the chat room are pointing out, yes, of course, there was OS X public beta, as in before 10.0, if anyone remembers way back when. That, you got to pay for the privilege of installing. It was like $30 or something. I think I still have the box sitting off to my right here somewhere. And that was a similar type of thing, in that they had developer preview releases of OS X. But A, there was probably some schedule pressure to say, is this a real thing that people can buy? And B, having a wider test group is a good thing. So it's gated by something. Then it was gated by $30 and the knowledge of that it exists. And now it's gated by this million people or whatever. The public beta has a public feedback application that it's right in the dock. I just installed the public beta right before the show. It's a little purple icon right in the dock. It's a nice looking little app where you can send your feedback. And I guarantee you they're going to get very, very different feedback from people typing in that little application than they would get from developers. And they've made it as easy as possible. As soon as you launch the public beta, it throws the feedback thing in your face, explains what it is. It stays in your dock. It says, click your big giant button, click here and start typing stuff if you think you've got a suggestion or a problem or whatever. So I don't think there's any particular downsides to this, except for the poor suckers who are going to download it and encounter some bug and be sad. But for Apple, it seems like all upside. I don't think any reputation that they get from people who download a beta, find a bug and get sad about it is going to really hurt them, especially since they're capping it, and especially since those people will probably get over it.
I wonder if one of the big driving factors for this might have been the 10.9.0 Gmail issues. Because that was like this massive issue where, you know, where Mavericks.0 had, and even I think .1 and .2, the first few Mavericks releases had many issues using Gmail and Mail.app. And that's the kind of bug that you don't tend to find in large numbers among developers, because they're usually not making it their primary machine and like moving into it and, you know, bringing their email over and everything. Like developers who are testing, you know, just testing out their apps are probably just doing a clean install on some external drive or something, or some different partition, and testing their app, and that's it. And so, and that was a pretty severe and embarrassing bug for Apple that affected a lot of people, like a lot of, you know, everyday users. And that definitely should have gotten caught in the betas, but it, for whatever reason, it didn't.
I think that's a weird one, because I did put my real Gmail account into Apple Mail and that thing, as I do with all OS X things. And the reason I didn't notice this thing is because Gmail never has worked right for me in Apple Mail. It is never, like, every time I do it, I go to, like, first I just try it in the default config. Like, it's Gmail, Apple Mail, you just do the right thing. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't work right. I move things, they go back to where they were. Things appear in one place, not in the other. It's not in sync with the web UI, all sorts of things. Then I go to Google's website and say, Google, do you have any updated advice on how I'm supposed to configure Apple Mail to work with your thing? And inevitably, it's different than the defaults, and I configure it the way Google says, and it still works in crazy ways. I just think that's not a tenable configuration. I never would recommend anybody, if you have a Gmail account, do not use Apple Mail with it. The only thing that works if you have a Gmail account and you want to use Apple Mail is to pop, which Gmail still supports, pop your mail to Apple Mail, which is terrible. Who wants to use pop, right? But at least that works in a understandable, consistent fashion. So I feel bad for the people who had this problem, but I feel worse that these people have been using Gmail and Apple Mail for years. Like, maybe they sort of got to a steady state where they understood the foibles and, like, you know, and, you know, the simple, oh, just don't, you know, hide all mail from the label from IMAP and do all the things you're supposed to do. Like, whatever recommended guide that they read this year, last year, the year before, because there have been many, many guides of how to get Apple Mail to work with Gmail. First of all those guides are different. Like, go back through the years and find the different guides. All the guides are different. They can't all be right. Apple Mail may have changed behavior. There may be updated advice. But anyway, they get something that they sort of understand that works the way they think it does, and then the behavior changes. And yeah, there were legitimate bugs in here that apparently were worse than they were before, but there still have to be crazy idiosyncratic behaviors. I mean, there was when I was testing it. I just can't use it as a mail client. I can't trust that it's going to do what I want. And the web interface to Gmail, when I move something, mark something as read, archive something, label it or whatever, it works. It always does what it was supposed to do. It never undoes itself. There's never any mysteries or anything like that. In Apple Mail, I never know if it is completely up to date, if my actions are going to take place, when it's going to synchronize with the web UI and all this other stuff. So I think that is kind of a lost cause. But you're right that if there are complaints about this, like if suddenly people's existing Gmail, Apple Mail setups that they were used to, like the set of bugs they were used to shifts to a different set of bugs or adds a worse bug, people will tell them about it and they won't miss it. So I think that, you know, if they had done this for Mavericks, they would have caught that bug as well. I'm just saying it for the specific case of this bug, I don't recommend anybody use Apple Mail with Gmail. Not in this release, not in any future release until, like, I think practically ever, because as much as Gmail wants to support IMAP, IMAP has a different model than the Gmail model. And I don't see how you can ever bridge those worlds without some compromises.
Well, and also from what I understand, you know, IMAP is a pretty complicated standard, and also Apple Mail apparently is not the best IMAP client. Like, it takes some liberties. Like, I was complaining about that problem earlier, and some guy on Twitter told me that he wrote an IMAP server once, and dealing with Apple Mail was hard. And I've heard that before throughout history from a lot of people. I suspect that the Google attitude, like, if some kind of behavior in Mail that is not quite doing what the IMAP spec says is correct or ideal, if something like that is causing issues with Gmail, Google is exactly the kind of company to say, well, we're not going to fix that. That's Apple's problem.
Well, Google does seem like it wants to work with Apple Mail, because they do publish these detailed guides with screenshots of how to configure Apple Mail to work with Gmail. Like, I think there is an effort there on Google's part to make their web service work with Apple's mail client, mostly because I think a lot of people at Google use Macs and like to use Apple Mail.
You think they use Apple Mail in, like, corporate and Google?
Yeah, there's Macs all over Google, and I can't imagine every single person is using the web UI. I mean, you're not. Like, there's a lot of people who just don't like to use the web UI for mail.
So. I would love to hear from somebody who works at Google to confirm or deny this statement.
Well, either way, I think that Apple is actually more apt to be like, well, screw those Google guys. Gmail doesn't really treat IMAP the way it should, which is up for debate. But, you know, they do that label thing. They do all this weirdness, and delete is actually archive. And screw those Google guys. We're going to do it our way, which is the way the spec says we should, maybe. And, well, it's actually Google's problem. I think that's much more likely than Google being bitter about Apple not handling things right.
I also imagine that Google does not care that much about getting all the details of IMAP exactly right. You know, if this is their problem, like, I said on Twitter a while ago that I suspect Google Gmail IMAP is not long for this world. I really don't think Google gives a crap about IMAP, and that shows it throughout history with how bad it's been. It hasn't just been like client side bugs; it's actually been like server failures frequently and stuff like that. Like, Google IMAP or Gmail IMAP has always sucked. And so I have to imagine it's just not a big priority for them, because it just doesn't serve any of their interests. And they probably just look down on it like some kind of crappy compatibility layer that they have to have for certain stubborn people who won't use the web app. That's the attitude that I get from them.
They still support POP, though.
Well, in the same way. You know, like, they support POP in the way I support IE6.
But they support POP correctly. Like, if POP is not a complicated protocol, they support it. Why would they still have POP around? Who in the world is using POP for their Gmail? Other than me. And by the way, the reason I use POP for Gmail and Outlook. And the reason I do that is my backup of all my Gmail email. I POP everything from Gmail down and, you know, just get siphoned into a big bin. It doesn't, you know, get filtered off to the, you know what I mean? But that is 100% reliable, and there's no way I'm ever going to launch my app and it's going to synchronize with Gmail and delete all my mail. Whereas if I was using the IMAP and it gets confused about the world because it thinks the prefix is different, it's going to be like, oh, I don't think you have any mail, but I've got all these local files. Let me just delete them all for you. It's never going to do that with POP. POP is like, it comes in, it goes, and after you get it, I don't care what the hell you do with it. I'm never going to touch it again. Unless you delete it locally, I'm not going to, you know, so it's just so much simple. So much simpler. So I hope they never do get rid of POP, because that is essentially how I have my real-time backup of my Gmail. But yeah, I don't know how you IMAP. I don't even know if IMAP is one of those standards where there's like 800 different nuances and there's no like official one. So you can all argue about, well, I'm complying with the standard. Well, I'm complying. Is there an RFC in IMAP, or is it just a million different weird implementations, kind of like the web used to be in the bad old days?
I don't know for sure. I do know it is a very large, complicated protocol that can do a lot of things. Like IMAP can do calendar syncing, note syncing, all this crazy stuff that almost no clients actually support.
Apple uses it for notes.
Right, exactly. And so I would imagine it's the kind of thing where like every client supports a different 80% of the spec. It's probably that situation.
Yeah. And then Apple Mail does all this weird stuff about like, where do you want me to put deleted messages? And then in IMAP, right, you're like, am I putting that in a place that also exists in the IMAP world, or am I putting it in a local one? And it's like, I'm always fighting with Apple Mail to get each account to keep track of its own. Where do I put my drafts? Where do I put my deleted messages? Where do I put my sent mail in a sane way? Because it's just so, so confusing, which is why I recommend everybody who uses email who's not technically inclined should just use the Gmail web interface and funnel all their email there, because the Gmail web interface will never be out of sync. You can send to and from any kind of account from there. It is like the Rosetta Stone of email. And I guess your punishment is that the Rosetta Stone is the exactly wrong analogy. Don't send me email. But your punishment is that you have to use a web UI. But it will always be in sync. And I can't even get my own parents to do that. So I am unsuccessful in this campaign to try to get... my mother insists on using Apple Mail, and she insists on having multiple email accounts. One is for spam, she says. don't even talk to me about it. Anyway, it becomes more complicated. It's much simpler if you do that. Someone put the RFC in the chat room for IMAP. They say it's RFC 3501. So maybe there is a spec, but yeah, like Marco said, there was a long history of, oh, well, this IMAP server is good, and this service doesn't... And like in Gmail, you're totally right. There is no IMAP server. It is Gmail, and someone put some sort of IMAP-like adapter on front of it and had to decide, okay, well, what is the closest analogy in the way the Gmail works to this operation in IMAP? And they just have to make choices, and it's weird.
So as riveting as all this email conversation is, can we go back to the Yosemite beta? Because I have a couple questions.
We are sponsored this week once again by lynda.com. That's lynda.com. Go there /ATP. Lynda.com has amazing video tutorials to help you learn new skills, whether it's programming languages, applications like Pro Apps, Office Apps, creativity apps, whatever you need. Lynda.com has amazing professionally produced video tutorials, and you get all of that. They have over 2,400 courses, they say. They add more every week. They work directly with software companies to get new versions and new betas. In fact, I guarantee you, lynda.com is definitely working on a Yosemite video right now, because now there's a beta out, and then as soon as Yosemite is released, they will have videos to support it. Lynda.com, they have people at the top of their fields, professionals who work in these fields, making these videos. And they put in like animations and diagrams and everything. These are very high production value videos. It's not just like some crap thing you find on YouTube or, you know, some guy yelling in front of his computer. It is way better than that. I've used lynda.com videos myself to do things like learn how to better edit podcasts using Logic. They also have some things with GarageBand. You know, I can't tell you. You just have to go try it out. And the good thing is you can go try it out, because you can get a special a free trial from lynda.com for 7 days. Go to lynda.com/ATP to start your 7-day free trial. If you decide to sign up, all the videos, it's a flat rate. You don't have to pay per video. You get access to everything, unlimited, for $25 a month, flat fee. No matter how much you watch, $25 a month. That's all it is. So, I mean, really... Hey, I say sign up for the 7-day trial and see how much you can fit in a week. And to help you out with that, they even have a new app for iOS. They also support Android, I think, but I stopped paying attention to that part. So they have a new app, at least for iOS, And that supports cellular playback, Wi-Fi playback, and you can even download videos to save offline to watch, you know, on the subway or whatever, or on planes. It's really an amazing service. These videos, as I said, are very, very good. They're highly produced. I was blown away by how good they are. There's a transcript on the side. You can follow along the transcript. You can click to a different part of the transcript, and it'll seek to that part of the video. It's really incredible. Go to lynda.com, lynda.com/ATP. You can learn PHP or you can learn a real language. You can learn applications like Logic. You can learn Photoshop, Illustrator, all these terrible apps that are really hard to use because they're all made for professionals. You can be one of those professionals and learn how to use these terrible apps in good ways. Anyway, thanks a lot to lynda.com, lynda.com/ATP. Thank you very much.
All right. So I have a couple questions about this Yosemite beta. If Apple really wanted to appeal to the enterprise, and I don't recall which one of the two of you said that, wouldn't you think there are better levers to pull than just issuing a public beta? For example, wasn't it you, John, that had complained and moaned and justifiably about the Cisco VPN client or whatever VPN client it was that didn't work with Mavericks for forever? Or am I making that up?
Still doesn't, because I mean, actually, I haven't tried it in Yosemite. I have no idea if it does, but the built-in Apple built in a bunch of capability to work with a lot of common VPN clients using like whatever the open protocols are for secure IP and so on and so forth. And for a little while, my company used a VPN that conformed to these standards, but it's basically the fault of the VPN company saying, well, we can't have that. We can't have just built-in OS support for our VPN. We need to innovate. And so we need to make a new protocol that this OS doesn't support and then make everybody install the world's worst software, which is like, you know, VPN software from random VPN vendors who don't really know or care anything about the Mac. It's gotten better over the years. I still feel a little wiggy using it to give an example of the type of thing that really makes no difference, but just makes me feel bad about VPN software. When I launch my VPN software, it has a little dialog box with a connect button on it. That little window, the first window that appears in just some location that's like the top of it is jammed up against the menu bar, but the right side is like an inch away. Like it's an arbitrary position. I don't understand how that position is picked. If I move that window, doesn't matter. Next time I launch the app, it's going to be right back to that other spot. I don't know where it stores that window location. Every time it launches, I feel like I have to move it. It's taunting me. Anyway. yeah, if Apple wanted to appeal to the enterprise, I don't think this move is a way to do it, because it is so clearly focused on the public, as in people who might like that. If you, I encourage both of you to go through the process, like sign up and go through the process. It is so consumer, like aimed at a consumer, super friendly, big giant text screenshots. When you try to sign up for it, it's like, here's what you should do. Back up your computer. You can do it this way. You can do it this other way. Like it's just step by step. And then when you download it, it makes you go through another big long list. It doesn't even show you the download link. So you can't rush through and click stuff. You have to read text. And then eventually, like it is so consumer focused. And the same thing with the installation, putting the feedback thing right in your face. This is for regular people. Now, I suppose IT people can do it as well, but IT people, they would just sign up for a Mac developer account and have access to all the dev seeds anyway, and they would probably be using it more like a developer, and they have specific apps or specific, you know, things that they're testing compatibility with, but they're not going to install it on their personal machine and use it every day for their work. They're really just going to install it on a test machine and try out all their supported software and report bugs to whoever is appropriate for the stuff that doesn't work.
Right, and that's my point, is that a public beta doesn't really help with this moronic VPN company. What helps with enterprise adoption is getting these moronic VPN companies like Cisco that insists on having their own god-awful clients to actually support new operating systems. I just feel like if what they're trying to accomplish is enterprise adoption, I don't feel like a public beta is the right lever to pull to get there.
Yeah, and wasn't there, didn't we go through this whole thing with the VPN? This is Cisco VPN, and I'm not going to call it the moronic, because again, their software works, hasn't crashed, hasn't caused kernel panics, unlike some other companies, Symantec, antivirus, oh God, someone please kill me. It's just UI-wise looks gross, but I think last time it was more or less that they had an update, but there's sort of a release train, and they couldn't get their update to support Mavericks onto the release train that would be out sooner. They had to get it out on the one later. You know, like I think that software like that is essential should, you know, you've got a long time to test with Yosemite, however long it's been since June and then to the fall, like it should be available on day one, unless there's something about the OS, some bug in the OS that Apple hasn't fixed that you told them about. And they're just like, well, we can't go until they fix that bug. I don't, you know, do I have to wait a couple of weeks? Is that a big deal? Not really. It's better than not being supported for years. Again, an example of that from my past is when Oracle didn't have a 64-bit client library for OS X for literally years. Like, and it was just, you know, that's just inexcusable neglect. Cisco was just behind by a week or two or whatever, and their Mac software is not great. But there's a range of stuff here. But a public beta is not even on the radar, I think, of these IT people, unless they're worried about their individual employees knowing about the public beta and trying to install it or agitating that way.
Right. And then that's kind of my point, is that the public beta may do a lot of things for Apple, but I don't think it helps with enterprise adoption. The other question I had, which I don't know what the answer to this would be, but where do these, what did you call the thing that was on the dock that lets you submit feedback? Whatever that feedback app is, what is the output of that internal to Apple? Like, are those radars? What is that?
I bet it's, I mean, they probably use everything. It probably all goes into radar eventually, but I'm sure they're tagged as coming from public beta in some way.
Yeah, it's just, I know that Marco and a couple other people, a friend of the show, Daniel Jowkett, and a few other people right around WWDC time were kind of going back and forth about, well, is there any real utility in filing a radar, blah, blah, blah. And this is not exactly a, forgive me, apples to apples comparison, but nevertheless, I just kind of wonder, if this is going to radar, that sounds just freaking terrible, because I got to imagine they're overwhelmed with radars as it is, I hope.
Well, you'd be able to feel like if it is going to radar, it would only be because that's the only bucket they have available for this. But it's not as if it would be suddenly cluttering up people's inboxes, because there's got to be a process whereby someone, you know, there's a first level triage of sorting through the giant avalanche of crap that's coming through the feedback agent to find anything actionable. And then throw it off into an engineering bucket. Like, I don't think suddenly after this launches, people who would normally troll through radars for bugs have a big flood of stuff. There's got to be layers of, there's got to be processes before, yeah, because so much of it is going to be like, you know, as someone just put in the chat room, I think the new Finder icon is ugly. Well, maybe that one's not, you know, not really actionable in the Yosemite 10.10.0 time frame.
Right. And I mean, I think you're right that the smart money says that it's, if it is radar, it's just radar with some sort of tag or whatever, or indication that it comes from the public. But golly, I mean, if we thought that radars were a black hole before all of this, I got to imagine they're going to become an even bigger black hole after.
But like I said, like, they're not doing this just for their health. They really believe that they're going to get, I mean, they have in 10.9, 3, and 4, you know, found things that they wouldn't have found otherwise with the developer stuff, with developers using it. They really believe that this way, this is the only way and the best way to get to find the bugs that they're just not finding when just developers are using it. So they're not going to let it just all sit in a bucket. The whole point of this is that it's, you know, it's a little bit like sifting for gold, but they're going to sift. Like, they're not just going to let it all sit there. They're going to sift for that gold and hope to find like the one or two weird things of someone with a unexpected configuration. And they're going to look for the big ones, crashers, data loss, kernel panics, all that good stuff.
Right. Right. And then my final question, not because I would actually advocate you giving advice of this capacity, but I know we're going to get a million emails. I've already seen quite a few tweets. If you were to recommend a backup strategy that is the minimum viable backup strategy in order to safely install a Yosemite beta, what do you think that would be in broad strokes?
A super duper or a time machine backup to a different drive, I think, is because what you have to protect yourself from is some catastrophic. Say there's a problem in the install process. Like, it doesn't even install successfully. Now your disk is unbootable. You shouldn't be sad because you just clone that entire disk to super duper and you just take out the bad disk, boot off the super duper disk, immediately clone from the super duper disk back on top of the bad disk, and you're okay. But here's the other thing that I could not fit in a tweet that people should understand. There is still a risk, even if you install beta and it seems to work fine for a while, and if you use it as your main machine, that if there's some sort of problem, like, oh, I used it for like a week and everything was fine, but then there was some kind of bug and the thing became unbootable and I don't know what to do. Even if you have a super duper backup from a week ago, there's a week's worth of work. And maybe it's just a day's worth of work or an hour's worth of work. There's always a chance of day loss if you did something somewhere and that stuff is not backed up. And people can be just as pissed. They're like, but I wrote, you know, 2,000 words of an article yesterday. You tell me those 2,000 words are gone? It's like, oh, well, you know, you just did a backup yesterday. You should be fine. No, there was a whole day's worth of work. Like, people are pissed sort of, not in proportion to the amount of data they lose. It's just an emotional thing, like, oh, that was super important. Or they'll restore from backup and go, oh, I didn't realize that I was actually writing that draft locally in my email client and that draft is gone, you know, or like you can lose data even when you have a backup, because if you keep using the computer, you're producing new data. And if you're not backing up everything you produce every second, and nobody could possibly be backing up stuff every second, you could get, I mean, this is a learning lesson. I guess maybe we should just let people go ahead, learn what backups are about. Like, if there's no such thing as I am instantly backed up all the time and I never lose any data, not yet anyway. Like, I mean, maybe with some crazy redundant real-time synchronous RAID system or something, you could have some chance of, you know, zero data loss. Even that, you still could end up in a situation where it's consistent on disk, but it's still meaningless because something was in the middle of doing something when it kernel packed. Anyway, so super duper a time machine, and you're still not entirely protected. You're never entirely protected. Even if you're using a non-beta OS, when you're working, if something bad happens and the whole disk goes corrupt or you have a hardware failure, you're going to lose everything that happened between your last backup and now. And nobody backs up every 3 seconds. So that's, you know, that's life.
Fair enough. What else is good these days, Marco?
Better than not backing up. It is Igloo. I wish Backlit was sponsoring this week. This would be perfect. But instead, it's Igloo. And they're pretty cool, too. So Igloo is the intranet you will actually like. And, I mean, so first of all, they have something important here. But let me just tell you quickly, because they didn't include this. Intranets are terrible usually. Theirs is good. They have all these great features. It's built by people, you know, who care. And that's saying a lot for an intranet company. that's unusual in that market. Igloo's fantastic, and it's free for up to 10 people, so you check it out. Now, they have a super exciting release coming this summer called Unicorn. We've talked about Unicorn on the show before. It has a ton of new features, but the best is integrated task management that will change how you stay on track with your work. Igloo tasks can be assigned in different ways depending on the work you're doing. So one of the coolest ways to use tasks is you can create them directly on your content. So why do you need this? Let's say when requesting updates on a graphic or a text correction on a Word document, you can create these tasks right on your content. So you and your team stay up to date on what has to be done next, and it's all right there in one place. When you're viewing content, even if it's a blog, event, or forum topic inside your Igloo, because Igloo supports all those cool things, these tasks are right there informing everyone if all tasks have been completed or if something needs additional work. You can assign these tasks to yourself or a teammate. You can comment on these tasks. You can keep all your changes all in one place. And when you're the one who's been assigned a task, first of all, I'm sorry, but all your tasks show up in a unified dashboard within your Igloo. As far as I know, they don't have to stay out in the parking lot outside. They are all in a unified dashboard with due dates clearly marked, making it super simple to manage your day-to-day work and clarify your priorities. Unicorn is a free update for all Igloo customers coming this summer. Once again, Igloo is awesome. They're an intranet. It's free for up to 10 people. Check it out. Learn more at igloosoftware.com/ATP. Thank you very much to Igloo Software once again for sponsoring our show. They're really good.
All right. Anything else on the Yosemite beta? John, you said you installed it, so.
Well, John has to install it.
Well, I mean, I don't have to because I'm on the dev builds. And that's one of the first tidbits. Like, we discussed this way back when we were first discussing the beta. I think it was after WWDC. And I said, well, they're going to do betas, but I'm sure that the developer releases are, you know, there's going to be a couple of betas, like, milestone-wise. But in between there's going to be dev releases. And that is the case. Dev seeds will, if you run the Mac developer program, they will continue to release seeds of Yosemite every 2 weeks or so. They're going to have bigger gaps for the beta, mostly because you don't expect regular users to be subject to that kind of churn. Like, regular users don't want to, even just doing through software update, don't want to update their OS with that frequency. So the public betas are going to be sort of milestone releases, and in between there, there's going to be smaller releases of developer previews, which means essentially the public betas may not necessarily correspond to any particular dev release. And I believe that is actually the case with the public beta. We're on developer preview release 4. I can tell you that developer preview release 4 is different than the public beta, and developer preview release 3, I think, was also a different build. So anyway, those are two different trains, all pulling from the same source repository, but that is a difference in the program. So developers, you're not really missing anything by not being in the public beta other than seeing that experience. The reason I'm doing it is not for development reasons, going on developer, but for journalistic purposes, just to see like what is this experience like and what is Apple doing there. They have a big FAQ on the thing, and interestingly, in the FAQ, I always wondered how they were going to handle this. Like, how do you, like, come on in, do a beta thing, and if you want, you know, if you decide you don't want it, what are they going to tell them? Like, oh, I tried this beta. I don't like it. I want to go back to my old thing. That's in the FAQ. It says, if you need help returning your Mac to a shipping version of OS X and restoring from your Time Machine backup, which they told you to do earlier, you can call AppleCare to speak to a support specialist or reference online documentation. So they're basically saying, look, if you join this program and you decide you want to go back and you can't figure out how, call AppleCare. And I suppose that's subject to the same AppleCare rules as everything else. Like you get whatever 90 days free and after that they charge you. But you, I suppose you could also show up at an Apple store and say, hey, I joined this Yosemite beta and I don't want it anymore. Put me back to Mavericks. And then a lot of people are going to have that conversation. And then the person on the phone or at the Genius Bar is going to say, okay, so where's your backup? And you're going to go, my what? And that's going to be an awkward conversation. I guess that's what these guys get paid for. But it's interesting that Apple is essentially saying, yep, we're here for you. If you want to, like, if you want to do this really complicated thing and you want to bail out of it, they also go on to say, but really, if you just want to wait a little bit longer, eventually Yosemite will be a shipping version of OS X and you'll be fine. And that's the final interesting point I wanted to make is that Apple is explicitly promising that if you get this beta and you just continue to run software update, you will update right through to the retail version, which I tweeted about that and people were like, oh, you've always been able to do that. Like, more or less, most of the time you've been able to, if not software update to the release version, certainly install on top to get the release version. But this is the first time that I can recall that Apple is explicitly saying this train of pre-release software will lead right into the release software. It's completely officially supported. It's not like, you know, you can get away with it and it will probably work, but you might have some weird like plist files left over. This is a configuration that Apple is supporting and that they're going to presumably test and make sure it really works so there's no weird leftover turds from the pre-release builds that screw with the release one. So that is
that a technical term?
That's what people are afraid of, that like some prefs file will have changed format, but it won't rewrite itself when you install like the retail version of the OS. So you'll be left with the pref file from the last dev build. And every time the app launches, it'll crash because, you know, some crappy thing like that that is eminently solvable, but just never came up in Apple's testing because they didn't really support you taking the last dev build and then trying to install the retail on top of it without like first erasing it or whatever. But here they're giving it their blessing and saying, you'll be fine, which, I mean, they have to do, obviously. You're not going to tell these people, okay, now erase your disk and, you know, or restore from your backup and install the retail. They just want people to get the beta and just keep doing software update, and that will carry them right through to the release builds.
Well, that's convenient.
I still don't really get the motivation for installing a beta OS. Like, on my phone when I was a developer for that, and that made sense. Like, now I am a developer for the phone again, and I still haven't installed the iOS 8 beta. I keep planning on installing the 8 beta 4. But I keep having other more important things to do. But like on the Mac, I would never install a beta OS on my Mac. I'm like, that's where I get my work done.
Well, you would if you were trying to add Handoff to Overcast.
No, I wouldn't even install it on my main Mac. I would install it on like a laptop.
Oh yeah, I know. Developers have lots of spare Macs or whatever. Yeah, like installing your main. Most people only have one Mac that is their main Mac. Like, that's the whole thing with like, that's why I don't think most people are going to have backups. Like, oh, installing your, what do you mean my spare Mac? How many Macs do you think I have in this house? They're like growing on trees, right? Of course, developers have a million of them, and hoarders like me have a million of them, where you just never throw them out or sell them, but regular people don't act that way. So, I mean, I don't think this is going to be lots of spare Macs. Or even if they did have spare Macs, the spare ones are going to be old, and you'd be like, oh, I'm not going to install it on the old one.
Right, or the spare Macs exist for some purpose.
It's the kid's computer or something.
Or it's, you know, it's the Mac Mini on the TV or something like that, or there's a server in the house. There's something, usually there's some kind of purpose for people to have multiple computers.
So, fun fact, when I was a kid, I don't remember how old I was, but like 12 or something like that, Dad brought home a box full of 3.5-inch diskettes from work. I want to say it was like 30 of them or something like that. And sure enough, that was the OS 2 Warp beta, which I installed from 3.5-inch disks, which took like a day and a half. And yeah, that crap was awesome. Oh, man. Warp was great. I miss those days. Me and Guy English, I think we're the only ones that miss it, but I miss it.
You're the ones who ever used it.
Also true. That and a bunch of ATMs. That was it. All right. Is that it? We good?
I think so. Thanks a lot to our three sponsors this week, Hover, Lynda.com, and Igloo. And we will see you all next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin. 'cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, 'cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental.
Did you guys install the new iTunes yet?
Nope.
No. Why would I do that?
Yeah, yeah, seriously.
It's got a nice icon. It's nice and nice and red.
I have been beta testing some new headphones, but
of course you have.
You're the rich person headphone rental service. I wouldn't think they would have a thing like that, but the whole thing about being a rich person is you don't rent the headphones, you just buy them.
Well, these headphones require a special amp, and to buy them both,
oh, I'm sure they do.
Right? No, but like regular amps don't even like these headphones are so ridiculous that a regular amp doesn't have enough power to power them unless you connect it to speaker terminals of a speaker amp.
My goodness,
is that the one? I read your big headphone post, and you mentioned one of the headphones that didn't have the power. Is this a new different pair of crazy headphones?
This is not mentioned in that post. This is the pair I mentioned in the footer, saying I would love to try these sometime, but I don't know where I could try them without just buying them.
And then people emailed you and say, hey, this service rents them out.
Yeah, exactly. And so you know, to buy the headphones and the amp would be like $3,000. And so that's not, and you pretty much can't try them in person anywhere. This, you know, you can't walk into a Best Buy. They don't have things that are this specialized, you know.
Do they come with the single directional oxygen free crystal enhanced cables or no?
No, that's most of that crap is what the aftermarket people and the hobbyists do. The ones that come stock, even on the fanciest cables or even on the fanciest headphones, the stock cables are like pretty low on the BS meter. Like, you know, they're balanced cables, which means they have 4 pins instead of 3, and they use giant XLR plugs. And that's to provide some kind of benefit. I'm not quite sure on the rationale there, but
so are these headphones any good? I mean, come on,
they're amazing. Yeah, oh. They're shockingly good. Yeah, that's the gist of it. But I'm not crazy about the amp. It's giant, and the volume knob. It's one of these things. This is really ridiculous. I feel bad for even talking about this. Rather than a typical pot on a volume knob, which is just like I believe they're usually just like a variable resistor, right? Isn't that
potentiometer? That's what pot is short for, right?
Yeah. Well, headphone nerds don't like regular volume knob pots because they're imprecise and they maybe affect the sound quality somehow, and that in some other ways, like there's issues with like channel imbalance where like the left channel might get slightly lower than the right at certain positions on the knob just because of the way they're made or their quality levels, whatever. And so the volume knob on this fancy amp is just like a notched selector, and it turns this giant rod that goes through the entire length of the amp. And it goes to this tremendous drum in the back where each notch has a pair of resistors, like regular resistors. and it's just like turning, it's like a giant like knife switch almost that turns between these pairs of resistors to just alternate. So like there is no setting like between notch 1 and 2. And it's just this giant drum of all these different resistors for all the different volume settings.
That is crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. I mean, it's like it's funny how crazy this is. If anybody in the chat wants to look up what I'm talking about, I'm talking about the Hi-Fi Man EF6 amp and the HE6 orthodynamic headphones.
Here's a question for your crazy audiophile people, which is just Marco here, but he can relay it if he doesn't know the answer. What is the general accepted wisdom about headphones versus speakers? Like, if you want, like, the best possible, whatever the hell their definition of best is, I'm going to assume they're going to say most accurate or whatever, listening experience, is it better to have, if you had unlimited funds to build like the building you're going to have this listening experience in, right? Just unlimited funds. Is headphones the way to go or speakers?
I'm not familiar enough with the speaker world to say. I can at least say that in the headphone world, I mean, one of the big differences is like, really, really nice headphones. Like the most of what people would consider the best headphones in the world cost about $1,500 or less. I'm pretty sure nobody in the speaker world would say that any of the best speakers in the world are below like $10,000.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's a pretty it's a giant price difference. And so that's one of the big reasons why people like high-end headphones so much, because they're so much more accessible. You know, high-end speakers are basically as expensive as cars. Like, they're insane.
Or more, yeah. No, or I, more, I mean, I'm, yeah. I'm just asking because it was like some, you know, because like there's arguments two ways. As people are pointing out in the chat room, the speaker argument is that no headphone is ever going to give you sort of that whole body bass feeling that you get sitting in front of a speaker that has, you know, a powerful speaker that has a bass, right? Like, it's not going to be a full body experience. It's just happening on your ears. But on the other hand, you would think all the things that can screw up the sound in a speaker as it moves around the room. And again, I'm saying you can build the room you want. Like, you have unlimited funds, right? Build it however you want. But all the things that could go wrong there, it's like, we can cut out all the middlemen and just get, like, I can put a thing right next to your ear, and I don't have to drive it with a lot of power because it's right next to your ear, so I can get, you know, super accurate or whatever. So that's the argument for headphones, is like, we cut out all that crap that... all the potential problems with sound in a non-ideal situation. Like, you're not going to build a building for your speakers. You have to put them in the room that you have. And in that right. case, maybe you're better off with headphones, because we don't have to worry about all the sound bouncing around all over the place.
Yeah, I agree. And my dad is a pretty big stereo nut, and he has a really nice setup, which is not limited to vinyl. Before I get a million emails, he has a fancy CD player as well. But anyway, it was a really nice setup with really nice speakers, and I don't even want to think about how much it all cost. But he swears, and as I've sworn to Marco many times, that the best speakers he's ever heard are some custom molded in-ear monitors that he got from Ultimate Ears. That are literally, he had them molded for the shape of his ear canal. And I know, Marco, that you swear that you can't use them and they're uncomfortable and blah, blah, blah. But I would imagine, based on the not custom molded Ultimate Ears that I have, which are far and away the best speakers I've ever heard, I can only imagine how amazing these things are. So to me, I would guess that an in-ear monitor or something like it would probably be the best that you can get.
Most people who are experts in the field and have tried in-ear monitors and really fancy headphones do not share that opinion.
Really?
In-ear monitors are very well respected. People love them, no question. However, people love full-size headphones better. And like the experts who review like all at the top everything, like, and this, it's a pretty small field, really. But in-ear monitor, I mean, and so I can't say, because as Casey said, I can't really wear them. They hurt my ears too much. Even the ones that everyone says are more comfortable, and I've never tried custom. Yes, please don't email me. But I'm very happy with full-size headphones instead. And I think, you know, it probably has just a lot to do. You know, John, I think you're right. Like, headphones can do a lot that speakers can't do easily. It is all about the room. Like, for me to build an audio listening room with speakers that would be the same quality I'm getting from my headphones that cost $1,000 or less often. I know that sounds ridiculous to pay even that much for headphones. I'm very aware of that. And I don't expect anybody to do that at all. But if you're really into high quality music, it's really a pretty amazing value compared to speakers. And it's just in practice, like, I'm usually listening while I'm at my computer working. It's harder to do that with speakers. It's harder to arrange the room. You need much larger things. And then the rest of the house hears whatever you're listening to, and you hear the rest of the house. So it just is so much more practical, and it seals you in. And so you're able to concentrate on things, whether that's the music or something else or both.
But you're not getting that full body bass.
You're not. Well, but it depends what you like. Like, I don't need full body bass. I think the other people, like my neighbors and the rest of my family and my dog, probably wouldn't appreciate the full body bass either. Headphones are a really fantastic way to immerse yourself in extremely high quality music for not that much money. And, you know, you can go pretty high, but even like what most people consider the best headphones in the world are about $5,000. And even those, almost no headphone nerds even go to that level. That's extremely rare.
The in-ear ones, like, that's even more cutting out the middleman. Like, let's just get right down in there. Just get right next to the eardrum. It's like, you know, the next step is just cut out the eardrum. We'll just go right to the nerves. But, you know, but, like, the limitation there, I bet, is when you get that close, now you're limited by what kind of machinery to move air can you fit in someone's ear canal.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true.
And so that's why I would imagine that the sweet spot for accuracy versus cutting out the middleman is probably not shoved into your ear, but you know, who knows? I don't know. I don't have fancy headphones.
All right. So let's talk about something a little more accessible.
Like M3s.
Yeah. Let's get, no, I wish. I just put a link in the chat and we'll have it in the show notes. John, do you remember this tweet that you tweeted at me? I don't know, a couple days ago.
Yes, I do. Did you get a PlayStation 3 or 4?
So I borrowed a PlayStation 3.
Oh, exciting.
And I borrowed a PlayStation 3 specifically to play Journey.
Woo!
And I have played Journey.
What?
And were you spoiled before you played? Did you know anything about it besides that it's called Journey?
Not really. I knew it had something to do with a scarf, and that was about the extent of it.
All right. That's a reasonable, at this point, that's a reasonable spoiler for you. Now, was your PlayStation connected online when you played it?
Yes.
And did you know that it should be, or was that just an accident of...
I guess I fibbed. I did know that there was potential that I would run into other people and that I may or may not be able to interact with them. Or if I could, I couldn't use text or anything in order to do so. Because I think I may have listened to the hypercritical. I'm assuming it was a hypercritical, but I don't. My memory's so bad.
You're spoiled, but you didn't. But your spoiler freeness is powered by apathy. You have heard spoilers, but you didn't care at the time, so you've since forgotten them.
Yes, you're both absolutely correct. So let me start by saying that getting Journey onto this PlayStation was so fucking annoying that it is a testament to how much I love you that I even played the game.
See, if you had told me you were doing this, I would have told you what I told Marco to do, which is to buy a code on Amazon for PlayStation points so you don't have to give Sony your credit card. Presumably Amazon already has your credit card and you're comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. And then you could get a digital code and then enter that code. Annoyingly, yes. But if that's the hang up that you don't want to do that. And it's super annoying to even enter your credit card in the PlayStation thing anyway. So,
well, it's funny you bring that up, John, because here's my experience plugging in this PlayStation and trying to use it. Again, it's a PlayStation 3. It's actually one I borrowed from my parents because my parents got it way back when they wanted a Blu-ray player. And at the time, it was basically the cheapest Blu-ray player you could get.
So you've been keeping this for me all this time that your parents have this PlayStation just sitting there.
Yep, that's true.
And it was a first-gen one? That's usually even worse.
Yes, it was very early on. I don't know anything about PlayStation 3s or really video games at all, but I know for a fact that this was bought pretty darn early.
You might have one with hardware PlayStation 2 support. That is actually a rare and wonderful thing that you probably don't care about, but is significant.
I don't care. I understand the words you're saying, but I have no idea why that's awesome. Anyway, so the point is, I plug it in. Well, the first problem I had was when I borrowed it from mom and dad, they didn't give me controllers, and I kind of forgot to ask for them. So I had to wait a few days.
It's going to make it hard to do anything.
You play with a Bluetooth remote.
I had to wait a few days until I actually had the DVD remote, comically, which is how I was playing the Blu-ray when I made that tweet about how loud it was. But anyways,
please tell me you didn't play Journey with the DVD remote.
No.
Okay.
So I eventually got a couple of controllers from them, and I knew enough to know that I needed to plug them in via USB, and that I was pretty sure that I could use them even though they were dead while the USB cord was plugged in, which was fine. Okay, whatever. So the first thing I do when I turn on the PlayStation, once I had bothered to connect it to the internet, of course I need to do a system update. That took, I don't remember, something like half an hour. Fine. So then I need to go to the PlayStation store, I assume, so I can buy Journey. Fine. Go to the PlayStation store. Well, you need to do another update. Are you freaking kidding me? I just did a system. No, you need to do a store update. Okay. Well, yep. Now I have to download this 65 meg update and install it. That took easily an hour and a half to 2 hours. No idea why. It was connected via Ethernet, via Mocha Bridge, and then all the way up to the router. I have 7535 internet. I have no idea what the bad piece in this chain was.
It's like you're reliving 2006 all over again.
Yep.
You can go back in time and look at all the webcomics that were acclaimed by this exact thing.
Yeah.
PlayStation 3 is an update machine.
Yep. So, so like 2 or 3 hours after I connect the PlayStation to the internet, which I should say, before I connected it to the internet, it did a lot more stuff and was a lot more fiddly than I wanted, but it worked. I plugged it, or I put a Blu-ray in the drive, it played it, and I was happy. But then I connected it to the internet, and all hell broke loose. So anyway, so I do the system update. That takes like half an hour. I do the store update. That takes an hour or two. Then I go to purchase Journey. I'm all excited with myself, and I'm going to purchase it, and it says, okay, you are going to pay with such and such credit card, which was my parents' credit card. Well, I don't want to do that. No, I don't want to do that. So it says, okay, well, you can't buy the game.
Well, see, again, if you had talked to me first and told me you're doing this, I would have told you you can buy Journey on an optical disc, and then you would have stuck it into the drive and started playing it. Well, I probably would have done an update first, but still, it would have been a disc.
That would have ruined the surprise, though. So here I am, ignoramus extraordinaire, at least in this capacity, and I cannot for the life of me figure out how to get it to allow me to put in my own freaking credit card number. So eventually I give up and ask Aaron, who is sitting behind me, to go ahead and just Google, how the F do you change your credit card number in the PlayStation Store?
Why is that the fallback frustration? Why don't you just buy it and give your parents $15? You're going to see them.
Well, okay, that was the other thing I didn't mention. That I agree. But whatever the credit card number was, which I called my dad and confirmed was the correct number, he indicated, or the PlayStation would not accept, which might have been an expiration date issue. But I couldn't even change that. So I didn't know what to do. Eventually, I try to get into, or I find that I need to go into like my account, or dad's account, I guess I should say, go into his like account settings and billing settings. Well, even though I'm already logged in as my dad, and it's happy with that, when I go to the billing settings, it says, what's your password? So I enter the password that my dad has given to me. Doesn't accept it. He goes to the website. This is from his house. I'm at my house. He goes to the website, enters the exact same password. Oh, everything works magically. So we do that whole dance for like half an hour, trying to figure out how the crap to get me in, to the point that I can just update my payment. All I want to do is give somebody $15, and I am going through at least half an hour to an hour of pain to do that. So eventually we figure it out. Eventually I can buy Journey. Eventually it downloads, and I think did so quicker than the damn store update, even though Journey was like half a gig and the store update was 50 or 60 megs.
This is, by the way, is why I recommend for everyone I tell to play Journey, dedicate a day to installing it. Do not play it on the same day that you download. Just take a day. Like,
and again, this was all happening last night. I didn't know if I would have time to do all this tonight. I have a serious urgency because I really wanted to talk about it today because I figured it would be a little bit of a shorter show. I am freaking out. Also because I'm high strung and ridiculous. But anyway, eventually I finally get to the point that I can start Journey, and I played it and I liked it.
That's it.
No, I do have other thoughts.
Thanks everyone, we'll see you next week.
No, I do have other thoughts.
I totally recommend spending a day more. And the reason I recommend people take a day is not so much because like, oh, the PlayStation always takes a day to install anything. It's because the people who I'm telling to play Journey, if they haven't already played it, they're probably either not gamers or don't have a PlayStation 3, which means they're going to have to either borrow one, which is worse when it's like someone else's account. And as you encountered, it's your dad's account. Imagine it was someone's account who you weren't related to. You had to deal with all those issues. If you have a PlayStation and use it all the time, yeah, it still does annoying updates. And still frequently when you turn it on, it wants to do an update. But you don't have like 17 of them queued up. Like my PlayStation 3 right now is completely up to date with everything. If I wanted to buy a game on the PlayStation Store, I go right into the store, I buy it, everything's all set up, I have money in my PlayStation account, boom, 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 wait for the download, which usually doesn't take that long, and play. So the experience for people who have and use a PlayStation 3 all the time, still not ideal, but it's much better than it used to be. To give an example, way back in the early days, the PlayStation 3 couldn't even do background downloads. So your thing would be paralyzed by downloading something.
Just like the store was yesterday?
Well, that's like more of an update, but I'm saying like you just buy a game. It's like, while it's downloading the game, I'm going to play something else. It'd be like, nope, you're going to sit here and look at a progress bar. So things have gotten better, and PlayStation 4 is even better in that you can start playing the game before it even downloads, which is one of the big features they tout because they have learned their lesson, essentially. All the things you complained about in the PlayStation 3, every one of those has something addressing in the PlayStation 4 to make it not be that terrible.
Does it still have a giant loud fan all the time?
Oh, the fan is so bad.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so bad.
The fans, even on the slim one, they're bad. And I haven't tried the current model, which is the one even smaller than the slim. But people say on that one, the fan is better, but you can hear the optical drive more, which is only not a problem with download games. But like they made it, it's so thin, like the sound of the little mechanism is loud. Yeah, all these things are not great noise wise. But I mean, at least the update issues are still a problem in that there are frequent updates. And no matter how smooth you make the update process and how quickly it downloads, if you're doing an OS level update, you have to reboot the thing. And it's frustrating if those come out more than, if those come out more frequently than you play, essentially every time you turn on your PlayStation 3, there will be an update.
Yep, sure is for me.
And that's what happened with this one is my my parents definitely use the PlayStation as a Blu-ray player. And to my knowledge, when it's in their own house, it's connected either via Ethernet or their Wi-Fi. But they never do things like go to the store, for example, to buy anything, the PlayStation store. So you're exactly right that in my case, I was set up for complete and utter pain and suffering because they don't do the sorts of things that I was trying to do.
Even early on, there was updates just to the Blu-ray player functionality, right? I mean, that sort of settled down and, you know, you didn't keep adding updates to that. But like, in general, I would rather have more frequent small updates than have to wait for like a 2-hour thing every once in a while, because I don't play the games on it that often. And these days I don't even use it for its like media streaming capabilities because I have all sorts of other solutions, mostly involving the Synology, to do my media streaming. I don't mind when I turn it on if there's an update. I factor it into the time I'm going to play. I don't say, okay, I'm going to dedicate a half an hour for playing. And, you know, I assume there's going to be an update because the last time I turned the thing on was like, you know, 3 weeks ago. I'd rather have them update the software than just leave me. But for example, my TiVo, I know there's a new version of the TiVo software out, but the update, I keep going, you know, check for updates. Like they roll it out slowly. I want the update now. So I like software updates.
This is one of those things that like, I think contributes substantially to game consoles now being so unappealing to the mass market. Like, so, cause it's like, in order to really enjoy a game console, you have to be extremely dedicated to it. This is one of the reasons they've lost casual gaming as like a main market, because like if you're a casual gamer, the experience of using a modern game console sucks way worse than if you use it all the time.
Well, I know, but like it's still way better than a PC, which is like the you know, it's all a spectrum.
Oh, sure. But, you know, compared to like in the olden days, if you had an NES or a Genesis, you could turn it on and you start playing the game. And if you haven't turned it on in 4 months, it doesn't matter. It just starts up.
But the thing is, like, there's benefits to offset that. And the benefits are that if you bought an original PlayStation 3, when you first got it, it was crappy and it got better over time through software updates. It could do more things, right? And it was, you know, like that is a phenomenon. When you got your NES, it didn't get any new capabilities 2 years down the line. Whereas you got your PlayStation, it did get better over time. So
that's not true. What I got the memory pack thing for the N64.
That's not an NES. That's the N64. And that's a hardware upgrade, not a software upgrade. But like, yeah, like, I mean,
I'm just being silly.
And the N64 had no fans and, yeah, and the controllers didn't dig into your hands, oddly.
Well, that's debatable, but yeah, they were a little weird. All right, so let's hear your thoughts on the game. Do not listen to this section of the After Dark if you have not played Journey, because we will spoil the entire game for you. All Journey spoiler conditions apply. Marco is allowed to listen because A, he doesn't care, and B, he's seen his wife play it 1,000 times by now, and Casey and I have both played it. But if you have not played Journey, do not listen to this part of the After Dark.
Okay, so the first impression I had, well, let me back up just a smidge. I thought it was like some sort of side scroller, which I'm sure is absolutely.
No, well, I know that. I'm glad you thought that.
I know that's extremely ignorant of me, but I just really don't care about these sorts of things. So
no, I would rather have you be ignorant. I wish you knew nothing about it.
So the first couple of impressions I had, well, the first thing I wrote down was that the soundtrack was good, and then by the end of the game, I upgraded it to incredible because I thought the soundtrack was unbelievable.
It is. You can buy it on iTunes. It is one of the best video game soundtracks ever made. Austin Wintry is amazing.
It was really incredibly, incredibly good. The second thing I had written down and was basically my second impression was that it was visually very big, especially when you thought it was going to be a side scroller. The world that in which you play is quite a bit larger than I had expected it to be. And I really was impressed by that. The other thing was within about 5 or 10 minutes, I started seeing other people, and I wasn't, I wasn't 100% sure if those were, what is it? What is the term? NPCs or actual humans. And I thought they were humans, but the one or two people I'd seen, they behaved in such a way that I couldn't really tell. And so most of the game, I was having this debate with myself whether or not they were actual people on the other end of those characters.
And this is despite the fact that you knew that there was a possibility that you could see other people in the game.
Yes. And so I thought, like, the background knowledge I had made me think these were actual people. But I tried to look at it objectively, and at first there was nothing that I saw that convinced me that this was a human being.
I think people who don't play games a lot have much more faith in computer-controlled players than hardcore gamers. I don't think that anyone who plays video games all the time can immediately distinguish a human from an AI, because AIs are so terrible in games.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, it's been a long time since I've played these sorts of games. But in any case, so I went through, I don't know, the first, I'll call it level, which I don't mean that dismissively, but I went through the first level or two, and eventually I got, well, firstly, I realized that this was a puzzle game, and to me, having played Monument Valley before this, it felt vaguely similar to Monument Valley, although clearly a very, very, very different animal. And again, I don't mean that to be offensive. I apologize to you, John, if that is, and to anyone else that really likes Journey, but that's what I thought. It was like, oh, this is kind of like Monument Valley. There's puzzles. They're kind of self-explanatory. I did, by the way, really like that the only sort of tutorial or help was occasionally a little outline or kind of overlay of the controller came up and told you to either push or hold something. But anyway, after a couple of stages, levels, what have you, I ended up kind of going through a level with somebody. And I didn't pay close enough attention to see that when they spoke, if you will, if that symbol was the same symbol I saw two or three levels later when I was still kind of playing with somebody. And what I did find, however, was that I really wanted to see where this was going and be cooperative. And the indication I got from kind of body language, for lack of a better description, was that this other person also wanted to play cooperatively. And so there were a couple of levels, like one where you kind of, oh God, I don't even know how to describe it, but there was like a center column and you had to go around different pedestals around the outside and you had to climb.
I know the level.
Okay. And so at one point,
I know, but go ahead, move on.
At one point, we kind of got separated and I was sad about that. And then it occurred to me, why am I sad about this? Like, I have no idea who this person is. I'm not even 100% convinced it is a person. I think it's a person.
Your emotion chip was activated.
My emotion chip had indeed activated.
It's because you know what? It's because your PlayStation has the emotion engine.
That was the PlayStation 2.
Exactly.
Come on.
He has the PS2 hardware.
Oh, he has the hardware support. Yeah, right.
Finally, I made a reference that you bombed on.
Hooray!
Hey. No, I didn't bomb on it. It was not the right generation of console.
You were just wrong. No, I was saying it was because his...
We never didn't establish whether his had hardware. I said it might have hardware support. He didn't know.
Oh my God, relax.
You just can't be wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
I finally got you wrong on something.
Anyway, let's concentrate on the facts here, but you're right. I realized I was kind of sad about it. And then eventually, like a level or two later, I wound up being next to another person. And it very well could have been a totally different person. But again, because I wasn't paying close enough attention to the little symbol that came up when they spoke, I had told myself, this is the same person. Oh, my buddy's back. And I was like all excited about it. I was really happy again. And it just, after the game was over, it occurred to me that that is a really peculiar reaction and emotional investment I got from something that I wasn't even unequivocally convinced was indeed a human being.
Well, now you can read my article on Journey if you haven't already.
I don't remember if I have. I want to say I have not, but either way, I was really taken aback by how emotional I got about trying to get through this with my buddy.
So when you got to the underground level, were you with somebody or no?
Yes, I believe so. But we got separated for a long time, and I don't know if we finished together or not.
Because that is, like, as you go on, the levels become sort of more fraught with danger, and, like, companionship becomes more important, especially towards the end of the game. And it's like, if you were with someone in the early kind of playing around levels, then, you know, that's one thing. But, like, later on, I feel like it's more important to be with somebody.
Yeah, and I gotta tell you, when those, like, creepy shooter kill you creature guy things came, that scared the piss out of me. And I'm still not sure, can you get actually killed by these things, or does it just take away, like, your ability to fly or whatever?
Now you should also listen to the After Dark with Tiff and I, and the what do you call it, the incomparable episode where we talked about Journey, because we addressed these very issues. That's the whole thing about the game. You don't know. There's no life meter. There's no hearts. Right. There's no, like...
Well, but your scarf got smaller.
Right, but there is no established gameplay mechanic where you are, where you're sure, can I die? Can I not die? Do I take damage? Does one hit kill me? If I, you know, the only thing you have going for you is, like, if I fall from a height, will I get hurt? And they sort of train you on that early on, that you sort of float and you have the ability to fly. So pretty much you're not going to die from a fall, but everything else is up for grabs and nothing threatens you. And when something does threaten you, the game has not established up front rules that make you confident that, you know, how much life do I have, or you know, can I get hurt, or can I die, or can right. I lose my abilities?
Yeah, and it was weird. And I should also go back. I forgot to mention, I was looking at my notes, that developing some sort of, like, language between you and your buddy is an odd, odd, odd experience. And I'm not sure if we really succeeded in developing a, you know, mega air quotes, language, but it was weird. Like, does just hitting, what is it, circle to, like, do a momentary ping, if you will, is that a happy thing? Is that a sad thing? If I mash on the circle repeatedly and so I'm, like, blabbering, is that happy? Is that sad? If I do the hold the circle thing and do the, like, really loud shouty thing, is that happy or sad?
Did you figure out how to sit down? You probably saw your companion sit down perhaps at once. Did you figure out how you yourself could sit down?
At, like, the end of a level?
No, anytime.
Oh, no. No, I didn't know that.
So, like, at this point, if you see someone in the game, chances are good that it's someone who's played the game multiple times before and they're playing it again and they would know how to do that. That's something you can do. One of the you don't have a lot of choices for actions in the game. You can move, you can press your little circle button, you can, you know, you can sing, you can fly, you can also sit and just, you know, sit next to somebody and hang out.
Oh, I didn't know that. So anyway, so I get to the snow area, and again, the way they... Anytime I play a game, which is rare to begin with, and discovery is how they teach you to play the game, and I feel like Monument Valley is a great example of this, I really enjoy that. And so, like, with the wind and you have to stand behind the little pedestal things, that was really neat, because it was hard enough that it took me a second to think about what am I going to do here, but it was easy enough that it was pretty quickly obvious, oh, duh, you idiot. You have to stand behind these, like, stone things.
Journey is not a puzzle game where you're going to get stuck. And if you do, like, that's why I feel bad. Like, if you get stuck and you get frustrated, like, then you're not like, the game has to meet you at your level. And Journey is at a low enough level where there's not this big expectation of gaming knowledge to get through it, because you don't want to interrupt sort of the flow of the game. The point of the game is not like a text adventure, like, you know, where you're going to be stuck on a super hard puzzle and figure out something really obscure to... You know, like the Hitchhiker's Guide text adventure. Like, the whole point of that game is that this game is supposed to, you're supposed to be able to flow through it. And if you get hung up on things that have to do with the game, even if it's the puzzles in the games, that's sort of interrupting the flow. Like, it's not that type of game. So I'm glad, like, that's, you're looking for a little bit of challenge, but I think more of the challenge should be, you know, emotional investment in your relationship with this other thing in the computer and your journey, essentially. Like, they put it up right in front of you at the beginning of the game. They show you a big freaking mountain with a light coming out of it, and they put a title. It's pretty clear what you're doing in the game. Like, that's the thing I forgot to ask you. When the game started, was it clear to you what you were supposed to be doing in this game?
Yes, with an asterisk at the end. It was clear to me that I wanted to step into the light, which made me wonder, is this like a post-death journey? Pardon the pun, but...
Well, but I remember, like, you know, in the beginning of the game, you just start the game up, like, it does the title sequence. Like, I guess the game is called Journey, so you're obviously probably going to be going on a journey, right? But other than that, did you know where you were going? Maybe not why, but where?
I figured I was going towards that light, yes.
All right.
Now, what I will say, though, is at the various, like, checkpoints within a level where you look at a mural and the like cut scenes where they exposed more of that tapestry looking thing, I totally missed the point of all of that and was not paying close attention to either of them.
Well, that's a shame because they are trying to tell a story. I mean, that's the other thing about...
Well, and that's what I realized late when I'd already missed like 2/3, if not 3/4 of them.
Well, I mean, not just the tapestries that you find, but like the cutscenes between levels where they show more in tapestry style. Like that's, you mentioned earlier that there's, you know, they just show you at the very beginning, like the control on the screen or whatever to tell you how to play. There's no text in this game. You don't notice until it's pointed out to you after, but there is no text, which is great for localization, which I'm not going to say that's the reason they did it, but it's an awesome like extra bonus boost. Out, right? Nothing to localize. But there's no text in the game. Everything is explained through, I mean, there's no text. You can't type to people. You can only do a little sing with your little symbols. That's not text. The cutscenes don't have subtitles. There's no one speaks at any point. The murals tell the stories through pictures. So do the cutscenes. So does everything in the entire game until the very end and the credit sequence.
Right. And so the one question, well, the other than can you die or not, the biggest question I had was, does everybody die?
Yes.
Why?
Just like life. Just like life. That's because everybody dies, Casey. All men are mortal.
And that's fair. But
what a great game.
I mean that's part of your journey, right? That's kind of, you know, I mean, like did you feel like you had failed at that point? Because I think
yes.
I think that is an intentional and natural feeling. Because if you are not spoiled and don't know that this happens, you feel like, boy, I've been going on this journey. I've gone through. By the way, did you get through the underground part with your scarf intact, or did you get, you know, a bitten?
I definitely got bitten once or twice, but I believe it just took a section of the scarf.
Were you trying to hide? Was your friend with you, and were you both trying to hide together?
We were trying to hide together for a while. And I think we both made it through, although I definitely had more scarf than he did at the end of it. But it wasn't very clear to me the correct mechanism to hide. I just kind of ran away from the little spotlighty thing and hoped that I was far enough away.
Yeah, I mean, like what they try to do with the jump scare in the underground level, like when the thing first comes out.
Oh, yeah.
The jump, right? They want to establish that, you know, I mean, it's like a little kid. Like, why should I be scared of these things? Well, because they startled you. That's why you're supposed to be scared of them. They seem menacing. It's dark. It's scary music or whatever. And the evasion mechanism is basically run away from the scary thing. Don't let the scary thing near you. And then there is a system. And if you go back through it and play it, you can see that they're activated and become aggressive under certain, you know, like whatever. But like the whole thing is the jump scare is supposed to be like, we don't have to explain how this game works to you. Scary things are scary. Avoid scary thing. And the two things you have in your head is, I'm on a journey. I have to get to this place. Therefore, I know which direction I'm traveling in because the levels kind of guide you. Like, look, I came from here. I'm going to there. Big scary thing is between me and there. I have to get there without big scary thing seeing me. So it's sort of a hide and seek type game.
Like, right.
It is not rocket science. And they're just trying to sort of at a base level, let you know what you have to do and let you understand that you want to do that in a way that does not bring you in contact with the thing that just scared you.
Right. So eventually I died, and then I followed the light, and then I made it through the game. And then the big reveal happens, or what I consider to be the big reveal, which was, and I don't recall the words that they used, you probably do, but these are the people that you encountered while you were playing the game, and there were like 5 or 6 of them. And that was an aha moment insofar as I realized, okay, that was definitely a real person that I had some modicum of a emotional bond with. It was also an aha moment insofar as, oh, that might not have been my one buddy that I thought I was playing with for most of the game. That might have been 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 different people that I was interacting with for most of the game.
It's companions met along the way, by the way. And when you see a large number of those, frequently it's like when they first, before you sort of team up with somebody, chances are good that you caught glimpses of other people who you didn't team up with. And a lot of the time when you see a long list of things, it's not that it was a different person in every single thing, is that you encountered many people before you sort of decided to team up or decided that was a thing. Only way to know for sure is to, again, look at their little symbols, which do vary from game to game and person to person.
Which I realized once I saw that screen. And I started to wonder, like, have I seen that same symbol or not? But my memory is so crappy that I couldn't remember with certainty whether or not that was the same symbol I'd seen on and off for most of the game.
After you died and the screen went white or whatever, did you think the game was over at that point?
Yes.
And after it was clear that the game was not over, what did you think was going on there?
I wasn't really clear. Like, so here's the thing. I never had done well in English class or with movies at looking at deep symbolism. I'm a very surface level kind of interpreter. And I knew that it was like the big white guys, right? And I don't mean that as a racial statement. I mean the white, the people dressed in white clothing. Didn't they like kind of save me and shoot me through the tube to like the happy place? Like, this is the worst description ever.
There's not deep symbolism here, and it's not complicated. And I don't think they're like, you can understand this, I think, entirely on a surface emotional level or whatever. Like, I mean, it's open to interpretation of what's going on there. Like, I know what I took from it, but like, how did you put it this way? Ignore who cares, like, what you think happened. How did you feel after the game continued after you died?
Happy for the most part that I didn't actually fail, because I knew for several reasons. One, I didn't want to admit to you that I didn't make it to the end. Two, I knew I wouldn't have the time to like play it over and try to do better. But also I felt a little bit gypped because I was like, man, what the hell? I thought that I was actually dead. And now it's like I'm not, which is by and large a good thing. But what the hell? That was a bit of a bait and switch.
Were you with a companion in the snow?
No. In the beginning, yes, but they eventually collapsed before I did.
But you were with them going up the big hill. It's just that they collapsed before you did.
Correct.
And so when you got into the after part, were they still with you or no?
No.
All right. So go on. So how did you feel? And how did you feel as you went through that last part and came to the end of the game? Like, you were by yourself at that point, I guess.
Yeah. And I mean, at that point, if memory serves, it's basically just mashing forward on the analog stick until you get to the end. I felt like I was probably supposed to be more into what was actually happening at that point, but it was at this point that I was starting to reflect on what had just happened in the game. And the other thing I will note is, I don't remember if it was before or after death. I want to say it was after death. But there's some point where the screen eventually goes white and you have to keep walking forward for like a freaking hour. And I was really confused whether or not the game had hung, if I was doing the right thing, if I'm just an impatient jerk, or what the crap was going on.
You're overthinking it, Casey. You're overthinking this whole game. I encourage you to play it again in a more mellow environment. It's not a long play.
Well, the pressure, so much pressure. I know how much you think highly of it. I wanted to make sure I got every nuance.
Well, I know that's the problem with things being hyped up like this or whatever. I mean, Tiff had issues on her first playthrough as well. Anyway, like it's never going to be for you like it was for me and for a lot of other people. Just because, like, it's like if you see a movie you never heard anything about and you love it, and then everyone hypes it up for like 6 weeks and then you go see it, like, it's not going to be the same because you've heard all these people talking about it and everyone hypes it up and your expectations change. And like, versus just being like, this is a new game, it just came out today, let me give it a try, and having your socks knocked off. And even if you had played this on day one, like, as I've said to many people who play it, you only get one chance for a first playthrough of this game. And if you have a first playthrough where you either don't meet anybody or meet people who come and go, like, that's a big risk now, because by now the game has been out for years. And like, you know, a lot, there's chances are good that people are going to be sort of coming and going versus trying to play through it as one go. Who's going to stay with you, how well they're going to do, how much you're going to bond with them over the gaming experience, and in general, how you're going to take the whole thing. I can't expect this game to hit people the same way it hit me, because the way I played it and the environment I played it in and my mindset and just the way I take in games, like, this is very different than people who don't play games a lot. You were more cerebral, definitely, playing through this game than I was. And I think then if you can get yourself to be less cerebral, you can have a different experience of the game, but you're never going to have another first experience of the game. So that this was your first experience and it was yours.
Yeah, but I will say I very much liked the game, and certainly I was struck by how emotional I got about being friends with my buddy. That may sound, you know, dismissive or condescending. I don't mean it that way at all. Like, I was really into hanging out with my buddy, and I really wanted the two of us as a unit to get through the game together. And when he or she eventually collapsed in the snow, I was pretty sad about it. And I was really happy when I saw that, what did you say? Companions that you met along the way or something like that.
Yep.
When I saw that, knew for fact that that was a person, that made me really happy. I definitely really liked the game. I feel like the best analogy I can make is that I feel the same way about this that I did about the movie Inception. And if you'll give me a second to explain, I saw... No, hold on.
I don't like that movie, right?
No, I know. But no, hold on. Before you jump all over
this me... This coffee reminds me of Starbucks.
What I mean by that is, I really like Inception a lot. And we can argue another day as to whether or not I should, and that's fine. But take it as fact that I really like Inception. The problem I had with Inception was I didn't see it until like a year or so, maybe even 2 years after it came out. And everyone I knew was like, oh my God, Inception's the best movie ever. Well, except you. Inception's the best movie ever. You've got to see it. It's so good. And I was kind of like, oh, whatever, guys. I don't care. And so I actually went into Inception kind of wanting to dislike it, which I did not do with Journey. Well, despite the fact that I wanted to throw the PlayStation out the window. But I went into Journey just kind of wondering what the hype was about. And with both of them, I knew that they were kind of overhyped. But with both of them, at the end, I actually really ended up enjoying them. And I enjoy Journey enough that if I happen to come across a couple hours of spare time, I'd probably play it again just to see it all over and pay a little closer attention to like the murals or tapestries or what have you.
And I would say if you do it again, go into it in a less cerebral mindset. Go into it more as the sort of emotional sensory experience and worry less about deciphering the plot or worrying about anything like that. Because really, I mean, you got the whole companionship thing. Like, that is definitely a big part of this game. You've got at least 50% of what the people who are making this game are trying to let you experience. The other part is sort of the journey aspect of it, like, that you could get just playing by yourself. Even if there was no other players, there's this other part of the experience that they're hoping to bring you through. With the companion thing, speaking of other mechanics you might not have cared about or picked up, like the sitting, when you were in the snowy bits... And your kind of scarf was freezing and stuff. Did you realize that when you touch each other, you sort of glow and light up and that fights off the cold and it sort of encourages you to huddle together? Or was that mechanic not clear?
No. Well, I knew that you glowed when you were near each other, but I didn't put two and two together in the snow section.
Because that becomes significant later when you're going up the hill, in that you're like, if you have established the habit with your buddy of now of essentially physical closeness of like being a way to ward off the frost, which robs your scarf, because it eventually like it eats away at your scarf and can, you know, I mean, the scarves go away entirely in the final snowy part. Right. But just, you know, the whole freezing textures encroaching on your outfit. If you stay close to each other, you can warm each other up. And so when you're going up that final hill, with that established pattern, you will be huddled up close to each other because that's what you've been doing for the whole snow levels. Like, oh, guys, it's really cold. We need to huddle together. Huddling together eventually stops working on that hill. It's, you know, you eventually just freeze to death and die. And that is more heartbreaking when you have this established sort of physical closeness type of thing that has been, we've been saving each other thus far. And now saving each other isn't working. And you had the same thing as you were separate when you saw him go down. It's like you felt bad about that, but like it, you missed out on that slight, small part of the thing. But I would say you would think this is a game that does not reward repeated playthroughs, because what little surprise it has to give you, like solutions to puzzles or just the game itself or the plot, it's all ruined now, right? You know everything that's going to happen. And yet, as I think Tiff will attest, it does have playthrough value. So I would give it a try, maybe not immediately, maybe let it stew for a while. I would definitely buy the soundtrack, because if I like video game music, I like video game soundtracks. Even if you don't, pick one or two tracks from the soundtrack, throw them into your random iTunes mix, see if you don't mind when they come on. And here, finally, my final question about the game, and Faith will be proud of me. Did you watch the credits?
Yes-ish. I mean, they were on, but I was talking to Aaron and my sister-in-law, who happened to be over at the time.
Oh, not the right environment. Other people talking, no.
I mean, I sort of kind of paid attention, but I would not say I read them, no.
Yeah. I do not do what Faith does. I don't watch the credits in theater, mostly because I want to get out of the theater. And it's not like, I mean, these days you have to, because the stupid scene that's the end of the credits, which drives me nuts, and ending credits usually aren't that interesting. But for video games, I always watch the ending credits, because video game credits, unless it's just a bunch of words going over black, but even then I'll see if there's an ending scene. Video game credits in general are not interactive, but an extension of the game experience. So next time you finish Journey, I encourage you to watch through the entire, I mean, you must have, because you just saw the companions met along the way. But if you watch the whole, I mean, it's usually just like the traditional thing is to show you all the places that you've been, to make you feel like you've accomplished something. Ocarina of Time is amazingly good at that, to show you all the people you've met, all the places you've been, the effect you've had on the world. Journey, it shows you all the places you've been in reverse order, all of them in different environments with other people in the environment reminding you of the things that you're doing. It's got great music during the credits. It's nicely composed with the text. You get to see the names of the handful of people who made this amazing game. And then at the end, you get the companions met along the way and a nice transition into the menu again.
Oh, yes. Start a new journey or whatever.
Yep.
The one thing that I wanted to say that I'd forgotten, which occurred to me when you mentioned the credits, is that I noticed in what I had been programmed by the late 90s to think of as a cutscene, like a lot of times when bridges were forming out of the like big scarves, for lack of a better way of describing them, I realized I could still jump and move and see my character jumping and moving. Like, you know, the Nintendo 64 era, that would have been a cutscene, which was non-interactive. But by the magic of technology, now you can like still move around while that's going on, which I was pretty impressed by that. I'm sure for you, that was like completely unremarkable, but I was like, whoa.
I like how you were impressed by the large world and Journey. It's just, I mean, it's the same thing that's happened to me when I tried the N64, because I had not played a console since like the Nintendo and Super Nintendo. Things had come a long way. If you're impressed by the large open world and Journey, rest assured that actual open world games are just way bigger.
Yeah. So anyway, so yeah, I really did like the game. I would play it again if I could find a couple hours to do so. And I am glad I played it. Sorry, Marco, for boring you to death. And now the only problem I have is that I need to read basically everything you've ever written on the internet and listen to basically every podcast you've ever been a part of in order to catch up.
One short article is like 2 pages long. It appeared in the magazine. It's on my site. You can just read it right there. There's a podcast, which is shorter than the one we're doing right now.
And all of them.
And I think that's about it. Just and then the After Dark thing with Tiff, which is even shorter. So
yeah, which I'll need to go back to as well.
Cue them up. It's not that long.
Fair enough.
In this time, I have run an alter table, fixed 3 bugs, answered about 10 support emails, and paid my electric bill.
You're welcome.
This is your punishment for not playing Journey when you were all set to play Journey for so long and just wouldn't do it. So now you have to listen to conversations about it, not once but twice. Actually, did you even listen when Tiff was on? I guess you couldn't because she had the headphones.
And see now, and Casey, see, your reward for doing your homework is John's telling you have to do it again.
Right? I'm telling you, you have to. I'm telling you, you might enjoy it. I mean, I didn't tell Tiff to play again, but she did, and she enjoyed it. So there you go. Oh, good. I'm making people happy, Marco. What are you doing?
Okay, my electric tables. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. I think the top-rated title, Not Suitable for Any Purpose, is pretty darn good. I do like that one.
Marco, you're the one. Jesus, Marco, we need to give you a remedial course on title casing. I was just about to make fun of this person who put one is for spam about their inability to do title case. I looked to the right. Author, Marco, do you know what title case is? I can give you a command line script that will turn things into title case. You can go to titlecase.com and type the words in, and it will give you. You don't just capitalize every word. I know they're confusing rules, but like if you don't know them, just run it through a machine.
I am aware of that. However, I'm following precedent that we have always capitalized every word for all of our titles.
Only because you don't know title case and you're the one who types in the titles.
Actually, not lately. Not lately. Usually it's me lately.
It's not a precedent. It's people our style guide should be established on by our early mistakes. No, just do it the right way. There's no time like the present to be correct.
I might also just just keep doing it like this. That way I can just subtly drive you crazy over time.
You're punishing yourself. It's going to be like when you go back and look at the Instapaper 1.0 screenshots, you're like, oh, God, how did I even ship that? These titles will be like this later in your life. Notice who Joe __, who suggested Not Suitable for Any Purpose. He didn't capitalize the word for.
He knows what's up.
See, that looks weird to me. Like, why isn't any then lowercase?
English doesn't make sense. Don't argue. Just follow the rules.
Well, there are certain, like the rules about, like, you know, you're supposed to put the period inside the quotes at the end of a sentence.
That's UK versus US. I don't think the title casing rules change for you. Anyway, it doesn't matter. We know which country we're in. Follow our rules. Don't be like Gruber and follow the UK rules because he likes them better.